Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush set the U.S. on course today to keep about 140,000 U.S. troops in Iraq through the remainder of his presidency. The president accepted the recommendations of his top military leader in Iraq, General David Petraeus, saying he will suspend further troop withdrawals after the last of the surge troops come home.
Beyond that, General Petraeus says he'll need time to consolidate his forces and assess how this reduced American presence will affect conditions on the ground before making measured recommendations on further reductions. And I've told him he'll have all the time he needs.
The president also announced that he will cut the length of American troop deployments from 15 months to 12 months, reflecting widespread concern about the intense strain on U.S. forces. The shorter combat tours will begin in August. Troops already on the ground in Iraq will continue to serve out their 15-month deployments there. Joining us now is Dmitry Savastopoulou, a Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dmitry, welcome.
Thank you, Anthony.
Does today's announcement leave any room for further reduction in troops in the coming months?
It leaves some wiggle room, perhaps. The pause that General Petraeus recommended and President Bush endorsed will take us till the end of August. At that point, the Pentagon's going to reassess conditions on the ground. But you have to remember there are provincial elections, in October in Iraq, and I suspect it's unlikely there will be troop reductions before that, because there's always a possibility of higher violence when you have elections. And then after that, even if there's a decision to reduce troops, given the amount of time it takes to put that process in motion, I think it's unlikely you're going to see a significant reduction by the end of the Bush presidency.
Of course, there's widespread concern, as we mentioned, about strain on U.S. forces, U.S. military forces committed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Will the reduction in these combat tours help that?
It will help. Admiral Michael Mullen, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and General George Casey, the chief of staff of the Army, have been very vocal that they wanted to get to a ratio of 12 months deployed in a combat zone, 12 months back home as quickly as possible. At the moment, the ratio is 15 months in a war zone and 12 months back home. So this will bring the number back there, but it won't happen until after August. So troops who are in Iraq at the moment and in Afghanistan at the moment will still have to serve out their 15-month tours. So it's not going to ease the strain for them. It'll ease the burden on some of the military, the soldiers and their families who are going to be deployed after August.
Dmitry, what do you make of this? We're reading that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq disagreed with a recommendation to delay further troop withdrawals. What do you make of that?
Well, if you look back over the last few years, you see lots of different comments from the various Iraqi politicians. I mean, there were senior security advisors 2 years ago saying U.S. troops would be out of Iraq by the end of 2007. Maliki is under a lot of pressure right now. He has launched an offensive in Basra to take on some of the Shia militant groups down there. And the operation so far has widely been seen as a failure. He's under a lot of pressure to show that Iraqi troops can step up to the plate and fill the boots that the Americans have been in. And I think that's partly what he's trying to do here.
Mm. Let's turn to reaction from Congress. The president has called for Congress to renew funding in Iraq, but members of Congress are arguing that the Iraqis need to do more to pick up the tab in Iraq. How did the president address those sorts of concerns?
He was interesting. He talked, on the one hand, he said that if you look back historically, the U.S. is spending less on defense as a percentage of the total economy now than it ever did during the Cold War. It's about 4% of GDP at the moment. During the Cold War, it averaged about 6%. So he said that the U.S. can afford this. It's not a huge amount of money in the greater scheme of things. On the other hand, he said the Iraqis need to take more responsibility financially. They have surplus oil revenues at the moment, and they need to start picking up some of the slack. So, I mean, I think Congress is pretty clear that whatever about troop deployments in Iraq, that Iraq should be paying the bill for more of this.
Do you think that's going to satisfy his congressional critics?
I don't think so. I think at this point, everything is boiling down to politics. The congressional elections in the U.S. in November, the presidential election, obviously. And I think at this point, we're in a kind of a political limbo land, which is going to stay until January of 2009.
All right, Dmitry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Dmitry Savastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. As protests continue over China's hosting of the Olympic Games, the head of the Olympic Committee has said that the Olympic Games are facing a crisis. Speaking early this morning in Japan, the Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, called for greater freedom for Tibet and said that people had a right to protest. But he went on to say that he supports China's hosting of the Games as the world's most populous nation, and even suggested that if conditions were to improve for Tibetans, he would be willing to attend the opening ceremonies. Here's the Dalai Lama.
I support Chinese because China is the most populous nation, an ancient nation. Therefore, they deserve for the Chinese people to make host of Olympic Games. In spite of recent unfortunate event in Tibet, my position no change.
With that background in the news today, our guest is Pico Iyer. He's known the Dalai Lama for more than 30 years. In his new book, The Open Road, Iyer presents an intimate portrait of the Dalai Lama that goes well beyond the celebrity monk often photographed with Hollywood stars. And Pico Iyer joins us in the studio now. Pico, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming in. Give us some background. The Dalai Lama came to the throne in Lhasa when he was only 4 years old. He was receiving world leaders by the time he was seven, I learned from your writing. So this is a full-time, lifelong political leader with a lot of experience. What effect has this early experience had on this person?
You're absolutely right. I think it's easy to forget or underestimate the fact that he's the single most seasoned political leader on the planet, having led his people for 67 years now. That's longer than Fidel Castro or the Queen of England or anybody. He was receiving envoys from FDR during World War II. He was dealing one-on-one with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and Nehru. And so what he brings to the moment and to every situation he finds himself in is this vast breadth of political experience, but also, I would say, political acuity. I remember years and years ago, I was talking to him in Dharamsala, his exile home, and he said, I'm addicted to something. And I thought, what would the Dalai Lama be addicted to? Impermanence, nonviolence, something like that. He said the BBC World Service broadcast every morning, and that if he couldn't listen to the radio news every morning, he felt something was missing from his life. He is a world leader who's following the news more closely than most journalists and as closely as any other world leader.
Fascinating. I'd like a little historical background, if I could. In the middle of the last century, the Chinese armies arrive in Tibet. Why did they come, and what did they do?
I think they just saw an opportunity. This was 1949. Mao Zedong had just come to power. He looks at this vast area in the center of Asia, strategically invaluable, Tibet, two-thirds the size of Western Europe. He realizes it's being ruled by a then 15-year-old monk. He knows that the treaties are signed or not signed many years before are vague. And so he moves into eastern Tibet, realizing that this is the perfect time to settle this centuries-old issue and to claim it for himself. The Dalai Lama, even then, over against his people's wishes, traveled to Beijing and spent a year going around China, and even then was saying the only possible response is to talk to them. If we meet face-to-face on a human level, there's some chance of resolution. If we just aggravate or demonize the Chinese, we're antagonizing a force 200 times more populous than our own, and the only suffering will be felt by us.
So he was finally forced to flee, and he set up Tibet in exile in India, essentially, which is his base today. You would think that in many ways this would be painful to him, but you write that he has a very different view of looking at his lot in life. I mean, he isn't there in exile feeling like a wounded man at all, is it?
No, which is liberating. I think most of us, I'm something of an exile, most of us hear the very word exile and we think of disruption or loss or sadness. We think of the past that's been severed. He thinks of the future and he sees exile entirely as opportunity. So the moment he came into exile in 1959, the first thing he said to his younger brother is, now we are free, which meant free essentially to get rid of everything that was outdated and confining in old Tibet and to introduce Tibet to the modern world and vice versa and to make all kinds of reforms. For example, women in the Tibetan community in exile are allowed to get doctoral degrees as they couldn't before. Monks now study science. His first year in exile, he created the democracy with its own democratically elected prime minister and cabinet and parliament, which Tibet had never had before. So he sees exile as a way to make a Tibet 2.1, as it were, to make a new, improved Tibet.
How does his faith inform his view of the Chinese? That is, You would think that he would see the Chinese as his enemies. They drove him into exile. Of course, there are people all over the world protesting today. How does his faith inform his view of the Chinese? He doesn't regard them as his enemies.
He begins every day by praying for his Chinese brothers and sisters, and he's indeed probably one of the few people, certainly one of the few Tibetans in the world, extending still the hand of friendship to the Chinese. And as your question suggests, that's because of his monastic principles and ideas. He's the most practical leader I've met, and one form that takes is to realize China and Tibet will always be neighbors. And in any neighborhood, if you fling a rock through your neighbor's window, that's only going to make problems that escalate. Even if your neighbor is oppressing you, the only way to solve that situation in a long-term way is to go and talk to him. And so that's how he regards the Chinese. He's aware that Chinese individuals have suffered under the strict government there, just as Tibetan individuals have. And I think he sees things in a much larger time frame and a much larger geographic picture than most individuals would.
What would he be saying about the recent demonstration of the Tibetan monks in Lhasa, for example, which turned violent, which got very ugly, and which incited the Chinese to crack down quite severely?
Yes. He would say, I understand completely your impatience and frustration. It's an important and necessary thing to speak out about the basic human freedoms you're denied in Tibet, freedoms of speech and freedom of action. But in passionately supporting the cause of Tibet and what Tibet needs and deserves, don't demonize the Chinese. You can be pro-Tibetan without being anti-Chinese. And recall that already the majority of residents in Lhasa are Chinese. So even if the Tibet question is solved for the Tibetans, you still have to work out what to do with those 200,000 people, perhaps, of Han Chinese ancestry who are in Lhasa. So his heart is entirely with every Tibetan, but his mind is thinking, as somebody who's been dealing with the Chinese for 60 years, what will work best with this somewhat prickly, prideful nation.
It's a wonderful portrait that you provide. You provide a portrait of a spiritual leader who urges people not to get too caught up with religion,
yes,
of a devout Buddhist and the man regarded by millions as the living incarnation of Buddha, who refers to Buddha as a scientist, a man who represents the Tibetan struggle against China, who refuses to refer to the Chinese as enemies, as we've discussed. I mean, he sounds like an almost enigmatic and surprisingly grounded figure.
Grounded is a perfect word. He's never been in a position where he could be a wise man on a mountaintop just offering philosophical statements or reminders of how we should lead our lives. He's never been in a position where he could be romantic or fanciful or abstract at all, precisely because he's been a king since he was 4 and he's been dealing with the Chinese and the Chinese occupation since he was 15. So I think much more than most politicians, as well as most spiritual leaders, he is intensely pragmatic and has worked logically to try to find out what will be the realistic solution to everything that comes his way. And that makes him extremely grounded. Though the ground that we see arises out of the invisible ground of his monastic principles, which in fact inform everything he does. And he still to this day, in the midst of all his duties, meditates 7-8 hours a day. And I think that's really part of what we're responding to when we see this very alert, compassionate figure.
We're talking with journalist and author Pico Iyer about the Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama. When we come back, we'll talk about what younger Tibetans think of his nonviolent approach towards China. And later in the show, we sincerely regret the inconvenience. That's the message today from American Airlines after it grounds another 900 flights for safety inspections. It's Here and Now. We're back with author Pico Iyer, who has written a new book on the Dalai Lama based on his 33-year relationship with a Tibetan leader. Pico Iyer was introduced to the Dalai Lama by his father, an Indian philosopher at Oxford, who first met the Dalai Lama shortly after he fled to India in 1959. Just before the break, Pico was explaining that the Dalai Lama has been dealing with hard political reality since he was a small child, and that he's never presented himself as the wise man on his mountaintop. Instead, for the sake of his people, he has embraced the practical. And Pico, is there a lesson here, especially in today's world, so fractured by religion, when, as you say, he actually urges foreigners not to turn to Buddhism?
It's counterintuitive, but I think he's seen what misconceptions there can be when people too quickly adopt a very, very foreign philosophy that comes out of a very different culture. And and try to translate it into their own terms and one way or another misinterpret it. Whereas I think what he would say was that, like any doctor, and I see him mostly as a doctor of the mind, he has certain principles that come out of his Buddhist practice that he's offering to us that are no more Buddhist principles than the law of gravity is Christian, because it was discovered by the Christian Isaac Newton. So he has just these secular ethics, as he tells us, that he can offer to us, whether we're agnostics, atheists, Catholics, or Muslims, and we can incorporate them into our atheism, agnosticism, Catholicism, and Islam.
Interesting. You write that he likes words like logical and realistic, and he tells you that Buddhist was a scientist, that he speaks rarely about faith, so it seems like he embraces reason even more than spirituality.
Absolutely. I think faith is a word you won't hear him use often, especially in the context of Buddhism. Reason, analysis, his other favorite words are interrogate, research, and explore. So it, very much his procedure, and this is one reason he spends so much time with scientists, is that of a scientist almost looking through a microscope at reality. And the other important thing to remember is that intrinsic to the Buddhist philosophy, and therefore to the Buddhist philosophy, is the sense that the Buddha and the Dalai Lama are just human beings. And that, in fact, is why they're so hopeful. They're not gods, they're not otherworldly presences who are performing miracles. They're people who are really doing what you or I could do if we choose to apply ourselves. Mm. And that's why I've noticed when I talk to him, the one thing that aggravates him is when people call him a god or people say you're a living Buddha. And to say that is almost to make a mockery of the whole philosophy that he's passing around. And the first thing he always says is, if you come here expecting magic from me, you'll go away disappointed. I'm just a regular guy. And it's true, I think.
He's a regular guy. To many, he's a spiritual leader. And as you said, he's a real political leader. Who are his critics? I mean, obviously, the official Chinese are his critics, but are there people within Tibet, for example, who say he should be tougher with the Chinese? Who are his critics?
I noticed this a lot in among the exile community of Tibetans, especially the young, but not just the young, who are more and more impatient and frustrated and ask the legitimate, understandable human question, how can we sit by and practice tolerance and peace and nonviolence while our cousins are being imprisoned, our sisters are being killed, and our country is being wiped out off the map? We can't wait any longer. And especially with the months leading up to the Olympic Games, they've been saying, and this is understandable too, this is the moment for decisive action, at least for rousing the conscience of the world to do something. This is perhaps the last time the world will be looking at China's position in Tibet for many, many years. And he completely understands their situation.
What does he say to that?
He says, demonstrations and decisive gestures may awaken the world for 5 minutes or 5 days, but in the long term, they're only going to rebound in our face. That kind of confrontation will only speak to the most fearful or defensive part of the Chinese government and will cause them to bring much more suffering on Tibetans who have already suffered already. He's thinking in terms of 50 years from now, 100 years from now.
The Dalai Lama is 72, so I guess the big question is what happens when he dies? Is he grooming a successor, or what do you think will happen when he dies?
It's pure speculation on my part, but you're absolutely right, and clearly that's the big question in his head too. And he has been saying for 39 years, so since he was 33 years old, that the definition of a 15th Dalai Lama is somebody who completely continues and advances the program of the 14th. But he's also said there may be no 15th Dalai Lama. It may be a woman. It may be somebody outside Tibet. And what he's doing, of course, in all of that, is preempting the very distinct possibility that as soon as he's dead, the Chinese government will find some little two-year-old boy in China or in Tibet, perhaps the child of communist cadres, and say, this is the 15th Dalai Lama. And they can do that, and nobody can stop them. But as this Dalai Lama says, that child will not be the Dalai Lama of Tibetan hearts. I think he's also practical and realistic enough to have worked out, but discreetly in ways that I don't know about, how to, in these extraordinary circumstances, to come up with an extraordinary answer whereby he may well depute a successor and tell all the Tibetans, this person has my absolute faith and authority. Please listen to him, and he speaks for me and speaks for the principles that we most need. But I think it's going to be a surprise whatever he comes up with. And he's done so many radical things as a leader in exile. I wouldn't be surprised if he changes the whole nature of the incarnation system.
As a practically grounded political leader, does he talk about his legacy?
So he doesn't think of his legacy. I, of course, have thought about his legacy. And what strikes me is that even as Tibet has been almost wiped out of the map, in our lifetimes, Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism have become part of the global neighborhood. And the thing that most strikes and surprises me in recent times is that the last time I flew into Lhasa, quite a few Chinese were going to pay offerings to the main Buddhist temple in Lhasa to seek out Tibetan Buddhist teachers, even to find Tibetan Buddhist texts. So I think in some ways the legacy and the inheritance of Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism has passed to everyone.
Well, he's certainly been an influence on millions and millions of people. Does he ever talk to you, or have you ever heard him talk about who were the big influences on his life?
I think the first one would be Gandhi, as a leader of nonviolence and as a champion of conscience. Mm. I know two of his closest friends and admirers and colleagues, really, are Vaclav Havel and Desmond Tutu. And it's wonderful to see him with Desmond Tutu because each of them lights up. You know, each of them has been working in isolation in very difficult circumstances for almost his whole life. And as soon as they meet one another, they think, at last, someone who understands me, someone who understands my
predicament. A kindred spirit.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And someone who really shares the same vision. And again, it doesn't matter that Desmond Tutu is Christian and the Dalai Lama is Buddhist. So he has, I think, more and more of those kind of colleagues across the world. Jimmy Carter, I know, is a friend that he really cherishes.
Hmm. Pico Iyer, what a pleasure. Thank you for coming in and talking about
this. It's been delightful
to
talk to you. Thank you.
That's journalist and author Pico Iyer. We've been talking about his latest book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. Coming up, Bill Littlefield on The Week in Sports. That's just ahead, here and now. A message today on the website of American Airlines says, "We sincerely regret the inconvenience." Nice sentiment, to be sure, but small consolation for the tens of thousands of travelers stranded at airports around the country after the airline canceled another 900 flights today. It's the third day of widespread groundings for the country's biggest carrier, the result of safety inspections ordered by the FAA. Micheline Maynard is a business writer for the New York Times covering the flight cancellations, and she joins us now. Thanks for joining us, Mickey.
Thanks, Anthony.
Today's news comes after 2 days of flight cancellations by a bunch of airlines, American, Delta, Alaska, Midwest. Remind us what's behind all this.
Well, there's a couple of issues here. The issue is mainly the whole idea of inspections and the close relationship that's developed between the FAA and the airlines. There was a situation that came up where the FAA was willing to take the airlines' word for the fact that they had performed the necessary inspections on airplanes. And considering the thousands and thousands of airplanes in the air, it might be impossible to inspect sort of nose to tail on every one. There just simply aren't enough FAA inspectors. But what happened was the FAA found out that Southwest Airlines had actually been flying 37 jets that had minor cracks and was essentially supposed to fix them and hadn't. And so those planes were grounded. Southwest was hauled before Congress, and now there's a review and audit going on of all kinds of what are called airworthiness directives, which are basically safety warnings that the airlines are supposed to tell the FAA they've complied with.
And as you suggested, this comes after scrutiny by a congressional committee led by Representative James Oberstar of Minnesota.
Yes.
And I gather he's worried that the FAA's relationship with the airlines has become a bit too chummy, and that's resulted in this lax oversight. Is that going to change now, this relationship between the FAA and the airlines?
Well, it may very well change. A little bit of background on that. Jim Oberstar has been someone watching the aviation industry for years. He's a Democrat from Minnesota, but as we know, Republicans have been in charge in Congress over the last decade or so. When the Democrats came back into power, Jim Oberstar got the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, and he's brought on board some people who used to work for the FAA and who know how the FAA works. Apparently, what happened in the Southwest case was that former inspectors approached his committee and said, you know, we're really worried about this situation. We think that these planes are flying that shouldn't be flying. They were given whistleblower protection, and all of this is basically coming forward in part because of an investigation by Mr. Oberstar and his committee.
Hmm. And it represents a real change, doesn't it? Because after 9/11, I gather the FAA was inclined to cut the airline some slack to sort of get them back in business, get them back in the skies, and restore some kind of confidence with the traveling public.
Right. I don't think anyone should worry about the safety of the system over the last 5 or 6 years.
Right.
I mean, safety was never compromised. And in fact, we haven't had a big jet crash in this country since shortly after 9/11. But I think what people worry about is the stress on the system, both the financial situation of the airlines, the fact that we have a tremendous amount of air traffic, especially in the summer. The airlines have really been loading up their schedules, probably heavier than the system can handle. And also, the planes are absolutely full because of the bankruptcies. The airlines not only added flights, but they took away aircraft, and they've been flying aircraft longer. And so, you know, it's really not a pleasant situation for passengers, and I think it's finally time for people to be taking a look at this.
Well, we're reading a lot about passenger frustration, about thousands of passengers being stranded, but we're also reading about concerns about safety. But you're saying passengers should feel still safe, assuming that they can get on a plane that actually takes off.
Well, and I think that's the issue. I don't think Americans need to worry about the safety of jets and the safety of aircraft. In fact, you know, my dad worked for American Airlines, so I grew up as an airline child, and I can guarantee you that everybody who works for the airlines considers you to be family. And even though you might not feel that way in a crowded airport, there is nobody at any airline in this country that wants to take any risk, especially the pilots. They want to get there too.
You reported this morning that these delays, indeed this chaos, could continue for weeks, even months, I think you said. How long will this last?
Well, what happened with the FAA was that they ordered this first round of audits of these inspections in the middle of March, and that was when we first heard about the situation at Southwest Airlines. There was a second round of inspections, or a continuation of this audit system, that started a couple of weeks ago, and now we're just beginning to see the first problems pop up under the sort of second wave. The FAA is saying that the audits will continue until June 30th, and they couldn't tell us whether to anticipate any problems, but given the thousands of flights that have been canceled in just the last couple of weeks, you have to figure if they turn up anything else, it's going to cause more disruption for the system. So the audits will go on until June. That's just this piece of it. Then we have the summer travel season, which has always been a nightmare for a lot of people. You have crowded planes and thunderstorms and all kinds of disruptions that happen in the summer. So I hate to say it, but I don't think we can expect things to really smooth out until maybe the end of the summer.
Well, it raises questions about this audit system, at least in my mind. I mean, I understand sort of safety is of paramount concern, but is there anybody saying that isn't there a way to sort of run this system without grounding, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of flights and stranding tens of thousands of passengers? I mean, is this really the way the system has to work?
Well, the first rule of flying is if you don't think the plane is safe, you do not put it in the air. You don't take the risk. I think the paperwork situation is another matter here. I think by getting close to the airlines, by trusting the airlines, that the FAA may have given up some of its oversight power. There's supposed to be tension between the airlines and the FAA, and some of that went away over the last year. So what we're kind of seeing is a catch-up situation for, I wouldn't say looking the other way, but for maybe a more casual relationship over the last 5 or 6 years. So that's what this period is all about.
I was going to ask you, both as a reporter and, as you mentioned, a daughter of the airline, you know, what's the traveling public to do? What's the best thing to think about as you're making your travel plans?
Well, one of our writers today was saying if you don't have to travel on Thursday, don't. And I might extend that into this weekend. I think the first thing to do is let the system work through all of this. I do think it's up to you to know a couple of different ways to get where you want to go, just in case your airline can't get you there. You should have probably phone numbers of rental car agencies at the handy, because this is not going to be pleasant. Some of the airlines, indeed American Airlines, has been paying for hotel rooms for people who are stranded, but we wrote about a woman who was on a connecting flight. I think she was trying to go home to Raleigh-Durham, and she got stuck in Dallas, and she may still be in Dallas for all that I know. And so you need to be ready just in case you get stuck. And I think now the requirement will be for the passengers to look out for themselves, because I think the airlines are going to be too swamped to really do a lot of personal service during this period.
Might be a good time to take the train. Okay, Mickey. Mickey, thanks for sorting this out for us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Anthony.
That's Micheline Maynard. She's a business writer for the New York Times, covering the most recent round of flight cancellations. And here are a couple of stories we'll be following in the coming days. Pope Benedict XVI visits the U.S. next week. We'll get a preview of what he hopes to accomplish on his trip. Also, a bicycle wet race that rewards the last place finisher. It's all part of the art of slowing down. We'll talk with the founder of the Global Day of Slow Living. You're listening to Here and Now. Time for the week in sports. That annual rite of spring, the Masters Golf Tournament, the 72nd, gets underway today in Augusta, Georgia. We'll give you one guess as to who is the odds-on pick to walk away with a coveted green jacket. And here, cackling in the background as usual, is our own Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Good to see you again, Bill.
Oh, it's great to be here, Anthony.
Now, Tiger Woods, of course, the overwhelming favorite to win his fifth green jacket. Is anyone going to stop this upstart and put him in his place?
Well, first of all, let's put to rest the rumor that said that Tiger would refuse to play unless they made the prize a blue jacket this time because he already has so many green jackets. There's no truth to that rumor at all. He is, in fact, on the course. The good news for his competition is when I looked at the leaderboard just before coming in here, he was tied for 14th.
Wow.
Now, this is because he had played exactly one hole and he'd parred it, and several people who started 20, 30, 40 minutes before him had a couple of birdies. So I don't expect that to be where he finishes. The answer to your question is, and this is an answer that people have been giving for a very long time now, he's a phenomenon. We're in the presence of a phenomenon. He's odds on favorite to win everything he enters. He didn't enter the little pitch and putt contest at the Masters this year, thereby giving someone else a chance to win that.
Well, that was good of him. He's aiming, I guess, for golf's holy grail, that elusive Grand Slam, which means winning everything, the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA Championship. Can he do that?
Oh, I think there's no reason to think he can't. This is a guy who looks as if he can do anything he wants to do on the golf course.
Well, let's shift to baseball, Major League Baseball. After losing their first seven games of the season, the Detroit Tigers finally won last night. They beat the Red Sox 7-2 here in Boston. Bill, the Tigers were picked by many baseball observers to make it all the way to the World Series. They added a batch of talented players in the offseason. They have one of the biggest payrolls now, but they're 1-7. Of course, it's only April, but what gives?
Well, nothing much gives based on what they did to the Red Sox yesterday. The way they hit, this is obviously a team capable of hitting its way out of a slump with the pitching that they have acquired. They are a team capable of pitching their way out of a slump. It's very early in the season, and I wouldn't worry too much if I were a Tigers fan. But if they don't succeed this year, there will be an awful lot of people saying that they wasted an awful lot of money.
Hmm. And what did you make of opening day? Not to make this too local here in Boston, but they were the world champion Red Sox, getting their Red Sox, their World Series rings. But what stole the show was the return of Bill Buckner, the man who let that ground ball skip through his legs in the 1986 World Series against the Mets and broke hearts all across New England. There he was, being cheered, all was forgiven.
I'm not sure there was ever anything to forgive. Bill Buckner made an error. Excuse me, Anthony. That's something that baseball players do. Hmm. They make errors. It's simply a fact of life. He had, of course, the misfortune to make his at the worst possible time when everybody was watching. But there was nothing to forgive. He was a great player. He had a terrific career. An argument can be made that he should be in the Hall of Fame. And the only real sort of argument for this event and bringing him back was he seemed to get a big kick out of it. And if Buckner got a big kick out of it, if he enjoyed it, then I say good on them.
Mm. Meanwhile, those perennial cellar-dwelling Kansas City Royals are off to an amazing start. They're in first place in the American League Central. That's the division the Tigers are supposed to be dominating.
Yeah, somebody flipped the whole thing upside down.
Yeah. But isn't that sort of what's great about baseball? You know, when the mighty fall and the underdogs rise?
It is great. It'd be wonderful. I don't think you're going to see too many underdogs rising to the top in these days of gigantic payrolls. That has a way of kind of working out. The better story, I think, this year, as the better story would have been most years, would be the Cubs. The Cubs, of course, haven't won the World Series. We've had the Red Sox win. We've had the White Sox win. All these teams that had gone so long without a championship. It may be the Cubs' turn, and they're very good this year. So that's the team I'm going to be watching out of the corner of my eye.
Well, like we say, it's only April, and a lot can happen. Turning quickly to hockey, the puck hit the ice last night to begin the two-month-long grind of the Stanley Cup. Bill, this is the first time all season we've even bothered to mention hockey. Is it time to start paying attention?
It's not time to start paying attention until we see whether the Bruins can get by Montreal, which they haven't done in a very long time. Call me if the Bruins get by Montreal, and and I'll watch some hockey.
All right, Bill. Thanks. That's Bill Littlefield, host of National Public Radio's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Thanks again, Bill.
Thank you, Anthony.
Coming up, the feet tapping music of blues harmonica great Lazy Lester. Stay with us here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now.
You're to see my baby, 'cause that girl's so fine. She loves me every morning, every night, and she's always on my mind.
We thought we'd take a trip back in time to a Louisiana juke joint for the sound known as the Swamp Blues. This is the music that bubbled up from the mix of country, Cajun, Zydeco, and blues from people who made their living in the swampland of southwest Louisiana. Musicians like Lightning Slim, Katie Webster, Slim Harpo, and Lazy Lester, who we're listening to right now. This is a recent live version of Sugar-Coated Love, which Lazy Lester first recorded in 1958.
Yeah, sugar-coated love. You're a real blind baby, but I don't believe it's fine.
Lazy Lester's long career dates back to a time when hit songs broke on a DJ's whim and recording contracts were written on paper bags. His big break came when he stayed on a bus and his harmonica playing caught the ear of Lightning Slim, which we'll hear about in a moment. Much has changed in the country, in its music and its juke joints. But despite taking some time away from the music industry back in the late 1960s, Lazy Lester still has the blues and is still playing the harp. He'll be at the Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans later this month, so we thought we'd revisit the conversation we had with him last August. We hear that you gave up a fishing date to join us today. Is that true?
I sure did.
Tell us, well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us rather than looking for those fish. Why are you called Lazy Lester?
Because I'm never in a hurry. That's the way I always felt about my music, you know. I always felt relaxed, you know, doing it the way I felt. That's not really lazy, you know, but...
Sounds like relaxed, laid back.
Yeah, relaxed, yeah. That's what they both say, laid back.
So tell us, if you would, the story about that day on the bus with Lightning Slim. He was on his way to J.D.J. Miller's studio in Crowley, Louisiana, where so much of that swamp sound was recorded.
That's right. Well, I was on my way to Rain, Louisiana, which is 7 miles east of Crowley. And I saw Lightning on the bus, but he didn't know who I was, but I knew who he was. And I asked him, I said, where are you going, Lightning? He said, I'm going out to Crowley to do some recording. I said, I think I'll go on out there with you and see what's going on with this recording business. You know, I didn't tell him I was a musician at all. He didn't know.
He didn't know that you played the harp.
No, he didn't know. Anyway, we got the rain. I offered the bus driver the fare, which was a quarter, to go on to Crowley. He said, now I heard you talk with this guy, so you keep that today. Maybe your lucky day. So we got to Crowley and walked in and met Jay. And he asked Lightning, who is the fellow you got with you? He said, I don't know. He said his name is Leslie Johnson or something like that. I said, yeah, I'm Leslie Johnson. He said, what brings you? I said, I just came over here to listen and see what this recording thing was all about. He said, well, we're going out to Texas and find Y. Bill, the harmonica player. Off we went out to Port Arthur, Bull Mountain, Orange, all over the place looking for Y. Bill Phillips, which he never found him. Came back to Lake Charles by some of his kin folks. They hadn't seen him. So we came on back to the studio. And he said, well, Lightning said, I'm going to have to get over to Henry. He called for Henry, and his mother said, Mr. Miller, Henry just left, and he go home to Baton Rouge because he got to go back to school. I said, well, uh-oh. Say, Henry's gone. I told him to go get me an A and a G because I knew that's the two keys Lightning played. So he went and got me the A and G. I recently got the guitar and tuned it. And he looked at me, he blew his mind when I tuned the guitar with the harmonica because I knew I wanted it right. And I handed the guitar, and he hit off Sugar Plum, and I hit the harmonica. He said, whoa, wait a minute. I've been running all over the world looking for him and got him right here with me. Why didn't you tell me? I said, you didn't ask. So that started it right there.
Now, you played on that session with Lightning Slim and also for Lonesome Sundown and others. And then on your own, you made I'm a Lover, Not a Fighter, which was a hit for you back in 1958. We want to listen to a little bit of that.
Well, there's people say I'm lazy. There's lots they don't know. Where I'm in the mood, I can't go, cause I'm a lover, not a fighter.
You're one of the last survivors of the swamp blues that was popular in the mid-1950s, and music that grew out of the fusion of the country and Cajun tradition of white immigrants, the Zydeco, and blues of the African-American experience. We can hear your love of the country blues on songs like Nothing But the Devil. Let's take a listen to that.
Well, you know yourself the good. You ain't treating your daddy right. You leave home in the morning and you don't come home tonight. It ain't nothing but the devil made you treat me the way you do. I'm gonna break out just like the measles. I'm gonna be out over you.
That's a great sound. I love that. Can you tell me how you grew to love country music?
That's the first thing I ever heard in my life was country music and bluegrass. They had this guy who used to come to the house to play cards with my dad. They had some fiddle players, banjo players, guitar and harmonica players, and that country just stuck to me, you know, and been with me ever since, and I still love it.
When we think about the history of the blues in America, it's a story of race and region, of an era. It was sometimes difficult business, people signing contracts on one sheet of paper, and the musicians not always faring so well.
That's for sure. We all got ripped off. I hate to speak about that part of it, you know, but that's the reason I walked away from the music.
Really?
One of the reasons. Oh, yeah. Hmm. I was doing better driving a truck, doing construction and playing music because I wasn't making any money on it. I still had the love for it. And still got the love for it. Going to have the love for it.
You on my side.
A wonderful tune. Now, you're a fan of New Orleans rhythm and blues as well. Let me ask you about the Lee Dorsey tune that you covered, Sitting Here in La La Waiting for My Yaya. It's on your CD, Blues Stop Knockin'. Mm-hmm. What is it about that sound that appeals to you?
Just the tune itself, you know. I mean, it's not big words. I mean, I don't even know what Yaya means. La La.
Baby,